If you are a curious human being, like, you want to be at the place where fresh and salt water meet. That's where the fishery is productive. Like, you want to be at the edge of the forest, between meadow and forest. That's where all the birds and the bees and everything else is. And sustainability is that edge. So if you're curious, if you like a market opportunity, and if you're just intrinsically motivated, like, those are the kind of people that I would really hope are drawn to the program.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged. Leaders Unplugged is real talk with the impactful. Candid, honest, actionable, and fresh from behind the scenes. Presented by IMD and hosted by IMD's president, David Beck. My name is Felix Zeltner. I'm the founder of Remote Daily, and I have the huge honor to co-host this new format together with David. And today, for our third episode, we literally take you behind the scenes of the World Business Council for Sustainable Development Education Day, a special event in Switzerland in partnership with IMD. David sat down behind the scenes with two sustainability experts and leaders, Geraldine Machette and Stuart Decue. And they went on a real journey from what sustainability means in this current moment where relationships around the world are being renegotiated, why sustainability is becoming integral to leading and building any organization today, and where its economic opportunities lie in the future. Fascinating conversation, fresh for you here on Leaders Unplugged. Enjoy.
Geraldine, you were CEO of DSM. You sit on the board of Nestle, ABB, Swiss Re. You're also chairing the steering committee of the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, and you are a passionate champion of sustainability. How did sustainability become a major focus of your work?
My background, I actually studied geography. I studied sustainable development, and then I became a CFO. I've cared for the planet forever. For me, sustainability is what people truly care about at home, with their kids, in society. And when you actually manage to embed all of these considerations in what you're doing, it is such a powerful drive for everybody. So to me, it became a very logical thing to do.
Stuart, you've been doing a lot of work at the nexus of business and sustainability. You lead the Yale Center for Business and the Environment. Say a little bit about what it does and how you got to make this so central to your work.
Yeah, thanks, David. And you're experimenting in an early part of your career, working in public policy or international development or media, and trying to figure out what's the area that you sort of see uniting things and what are the motivating factors and where do you inject a human element into it? For me, that was sustainability. And discovering and finding that at an early point in my career then led me to run the Yale Center for Business and the Environment. And that's a joint initiative between the Yale School of Management and the Yale School of the Environment that really focuses on catalyzing and accelerating the transition to a just and thriving world. And what does that look like in practice, though? It's like those are nice to say, but then when you're actually doing it, really it's an action-based and a center with a bias towards action. So always running experiments that are actually in the world and in the field. And so whether you're running large-scale field trials on how solar goes viral with a leading academic to sort of see how people adopt that, or you're trying to start and support the earliest stage of ideas on campus that can then become much larger and hopefully be acquired by a company, like the ones that you run. And then also building intentionally and thoughtfully networks, because relationships are a huge form of wealth. And within this kind of injection of humanity back into it, when you think about the kind of collective intelligence and power of the people around you, like the interdisciplinary nature, like so many interesting things happen at the edges of thought, and that's what makes sustainability attractive. And so like I'm drawn to that because I love politics and technology and business models and organizational behavior, and that all comes together in sustainability.
What I love about having both of you here is that you're both passionate about this nexus of business and sustainability, but one of you is been based in Europe for most of her career. The other one is based in the US. You've been in the private sector, you've been in academia, and yet there are these sort of big developments that affect everybody who works in this space. You know, here we have this sort of discontinuity from a sustainability point of view with the new US administration. How have you been processing the impact of this pretty dramatic policy change in the US on this really important agenda that you've been dedicating so much of your lives to?
It's a lot to take in. I mean, let's just start with the fact that there's an incredible amount of information to process. You have an information overload. Once you sort of look past that, you reground in the physics and what are the long-term trends. And so if you look at the energy transition and you ask, well, Can you switch from the dominant form of capacity addition in the United States, which is solar and storage, or solar, wind, and storage? Can you switch to natural gas? Well, you can't buy a natural gas turbine until 2029 or 2030. You simply cannot get your hands on one to develop that. So, like, there will be capacity additions in the United States that happen in the very near term because of the growth in electrification, of just better motors, electric vehicles, AI, data centers. Like, someone has to meet that. So I think you have to see sort of, there's certain areas where I can project out and see this very clearly, and others where the relationship is being renegotiated in a way that's very difficult to understand at the moment. And that is difficult to process on diversity, equity, and inclusion, the relationship between academia and government, the way that we think about civil service. Like, there are huge questions that are being kind of shaken at institutions right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's, to be honest, from a European perspective, of course, there was some inkling that there would be change. But the extent, the speed, the disruption, it's taking people by surprise. Now, I think it's very difficult. But on a positive, I do believe that in some respects, it is pulling sustainability into the strategic conversation of companies, whereas before it could be seen as either a bit of a nice to have or a very gradual evolution or kind of go with the flow. Now you're actually going to have to speak up. Now you're going to have to make choices. And it's not easy. But I'm a big believer that when there's disruptions, there's opportunities. So I see it as a moment of competitive advantage for some corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, that yes, there's disruption now, but if you take short-term versus long-term, if you stick to your guns, you probably end up in front of the race at some stage. But the question is, you know, are you going to do that? Yeah. DEI is maybe a very good example. Yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. In some jurisdictions, if you do not have DEI policies, if you do not have KPIs, if you do not try to move things, you are actually going against the law. And now in the US, you know, you get shot down for having it. So it's a little bit throwing the cards in the air. Yeah. But in some respects, it's bringing very potentially valuable conversations to the boardroom.
You know what I think is really interesting there too is the European perspective would be that it's surprising. I think I've also hearing from like corporate leaders in the United States who are incredibly surprised. And I would say that some of those are like, you read surveys from the oil and gas industry. This is the most uncertain time I've seen in my career in the United States because of we had high profits. We had a lot of stability. Like, we're the number one oil and gas producer in the world. Like, things are going great. You know, utilities that have cross-border trading between Canada and the United States of like, what does the tariff mean? The auto industry, talking about very traditional industries that are now grappling with a huge uncertainty and shock. And there's a whole renegotiation there that they're trying to figure out about, well, what's our relationship to government and how do we think about this? And what's the framework that we have for kind of collaboration and trade, which came up today. And I thought IND did a masterful job of starting the conversation on what are some of those global trends and how do they work and what are the effects? The energy security question, there was just a wonderful report by Carlyle called The New Jewel Order that focused on energy security being the key driver of actual adoption of sustainable technologies and climate tech, that would be the thing that pushed it forward in Europe, in the United States, and in lots of places.
Of course, what brought us together here today on the IMD campus in Lausanne is we had this Education Day hosted by the World Business Council for Sustainable Development together with Yale and with IMD. We had about 90 leaders from companies here for a day of learning, reflection, re-energizing, reskilling around these topics. And I think what you heard, or what we heard, is very consistent with what you both said, right? To some extent, you could almost say that this sort of, it flushes out the greenwashing. It sort of gets rid of perhaps some of the, this is the positive take, right? The performative elements, and brings us back to the business case for DE&I. We know that organizations that reflect the diversity of the stakeholders they serve tend to perform better. We return to the business case for sustainability. Circularity avoids waste. Renewables tend to be cheaper than other. Is that sort of the hopeful case here, that we actually focus on the basics, on the fundamentals?
Maybe if you allow me a little bit back to the development in the US. We were just sharing earlier, from a European perspective, a year and a half, 2 years ago, we were so jealous of the Inflation Reduction Act. The mindset in Europe was the US has got it spot on. They put carrots, not sticks. Europe is very good at sticks, you know, trying to get things to move in the right direction. It is actually accelerating the transition. And the big fear was US and China going to leapfrog Europe. We wanted to be the geography that leads the green transition. And now that's why there's a bit of a stunned look on everybody's face. It's like, hang on a second, you're giving that up? Which, by the way, opens opportunity. Because suddenly, oh, you guys are completely going in another direction, which means maybe that increases space for others. So I don't know whether that resonates at all, but we are a little bit like, have we read this right? You know, or have we missed something?
No, it really does resonate. And I think like the story is still being written in the United States right now. And in interesting ways, like we'll see how durable the Inflation Reduction Act is. There's a wonderful resource by MIT and the Rhodium Group that shows where all the investment has happened since the Inflation Reduction Act. 85% of it has gone to right of center districts that voted for Trump. And so you have created the idea of an industrial policy that focuses on changing the political economy around, you know, the energy transition and these investments. And so these are all centered in places where they could be very influential. But does the current administration actually respond to the way that a political economy would work under normal scenarios and situations? And these are open questions that we really don't know. But there are, prior to the election, 17 Republicans in the House of Representatives signed a letter to Congress, that they have a dear colleague letter saying they wanted to keep these provisions in, which when you have razor thin might like in the House of Representatives matters. There are now 22 that have signed on post because you're beginning to see more and more of those actually indicate, well, there's huge investments taking place. I can see a Hyundai factory going up. There's a battery belt in Ohio. There's a battery belt in Atlanta. So I it's unclear what's going to happen. It certainly looks like it is on the chopping block politically because of all the changes that are there in the tax bill, but we really don't know. I also want to pick up on a point that I thought you made was really wonderful on the reporting elements, which is, I think about what it unlocks for the sustainability professional. If that person is focused on innovation and the business case and figuring out what the due diligence of better investments are, that's a powerful thing to unlock in your organization rather than having them focused on compliance or reporting. And so if those requirements go down, what does that actually do for the human capital to kind of increase its potential?
Yeah, I spoke to a CEO not too long ago, a European CEO. He said, you know, we had to hire or deploy 50 people just on CSRD reporting. And she said, we didn't create a single innovation that actually made a difference in terms of sustainability. You know, it's just the reporting part. And of course, the idea is that that surfaces information and gives stakeholders the right information, including your investors. But I think you're quite right. Europeans have realized that maybe that went a little bit too far, and it came at the expense, actually, of motivating people to focus on the innovation piece.
And I mean, smart organizations are rotating people in and out of those roles so they don't burn out, right? Like, what does that say about the function is that you have to, you're going to like basically kind of suck the motivation out of an incredibly bright, talented human being and then fill them back up with another role. Like, we shouldn't be designing work like that.
Yeah, I think there's two elements. One is rebuilding trust in corporations when it comes to sustainability. So there is a need for a systematic way of providing transparency to society. And that shows that companies hold themselves accountable on multiple fronts, be it social, be it environmental, et cetera. So to some extent, I think we really mustn't completely give up of say, okay, you know, free rein, focus on innovation, et cetera. Because unfortunately, I don't trust that that will not necessarily then slip off to the wrong end of development. However, certainly when there is far too much, then you do put all your resources on reporting and not on actually doing. Now, when I mean sustainability could become more strategic because of maybe an ability to make more choice, is that if you're going to position your organization because you are in a certain sector and you say, this is where it really matters for us, it also means that there's some things you're going to officially say, this matters a bit less. And that, of course, tends to create a reaction from civil society, et cetera. So if you're going to do it, you need to be very aligned from top to bottom in an organization that this is the choice. And it's going to also mean that your capital allocation decisions, your investment decisions, your even potentially M&A decisions will be informed by this choice. And so I find it very exciting that it actually brings it and embeds it virtually by definition into the bigger conversation of where is this company going, what is going to make it success, and how is it going to be successful by contributing on the right things. And the where we came from was a little bit sort of go with the flow, don't create a ripple, you know, kind of provide a little bit of something on everything and you will be okay. But those were not so strategic.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that resonates.
It does. Can I get an example that's a public one that I think is like on the Amazon, they have a climate pledge that sits at the corporate level and they look at investing in companies like minority positions or others that they can actually then incorporate into their supply chain. And they wanted to electrify their vehicle fleet. And they went out to all the car manufacturers and said, we'd love to purchase 100,000 vehicles for you to do this. And no, everyone sort of turned them away. So they went to Rivian. And they said, you know, will you be able to build these? And they said, well, yeah, we'd love to have that. And they put $1 billion into Rivian as a minority position. And then when Rivian's S1 came out and they're able to say, we're going public, they're able to say Amazon is a huge customer and client. And so then you have a virtuous cycle of like you are investing in and taking a position in the thing that is going to drive like both competitive advantage for you. It's going to, you know, reduce your climate impact. And you're seeing a virtuous cycle of the valuation of that investment also increasing because of your involvement. So that's a really interesting kind of strategic investment.
You're based on a college campus. You have a lot of passionate young people around you. How do they, how might they respond to a message, you know, from a board, from a CEO who says, look, you know, these few things when it comes to sustainability, we care about a lot. Those things, eh, not so much.
It depends on the person you're talking to. You see these focused, quiet activists that are there that have that same like focus, the tempered radicals, the ones who are looking long-term and where I can influence and change a system. And then you see people who are just coming into this and seeing every challenge and issue that's there. And I think if you feel overwhelmed, you sort of can strike out and not have focus. You have to have a focused bias towards action if you're going to make any difference in the world. And so you have to choose.
It's a strategy.
I like that conversation about the quiet corporate activists.
Yes.
It was very much about that conversation around, you know, if you change a bit your language, is it green hushing or is it sticking to your guns but not getting distracted by the noise that comes with, you know, making lots of statements about it. It reminded me that actually in Europe for a long time when, I mean, I was a chief financial officer 20 years ago for listed corporations, et cetera, already, it was not an era where you could easily say, you know, we're going to push financial and non-financial performance. And by the way, we're going to do well because we're going to do good. That was not an easy sell. So I ended up being the CEO of a company that 15 years before the curve had 50% financial incentives, 50% non-financial, including environmental and social. But we didn't tell anybody. We didn't make a fuss about it because it was actually distracting. And I remember that we fast forwarded 15 years later when it became a little more practice. And once I was actually in New York and there was investors and a fund manager asking me, he said, but help me. So in fact, you've been acting as a B Corp for the last 15 years. And I went, yes. Oh, we didn't realize. I said, no, you probably would have scared. Because at the time, it would have seemed distraction, you know, lack of focus, et cetera. But in fact, it was the essence of the company. It's how we attracted the talent. Mm-hmm. It's how we managed to focus our innovation and make all the right choices. But we decided to do it on the quiet, right? And then it became more explicit when maybe the world was ready for it. So the reason why I'm sharing this is I think this sort of quiet, I don't know if activism is right, but quiet corporate determination to keep moving forward, to keep doing the right things, is actually going to probably be substantial. And today, you know, we had, 90 companies were represented?
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised by the vast majority of people with us were saying, yeah, we're hearing all this noise. It's not changing what we're doing. It's not changing our policies.
Right.
It's not changing our focus areas. We are going to continue because we believe this is the right thing to do. So I came out of today feeling a lot more positive. I was expecting the mood to be a bit more downbeat and sort of depressed. Mm-hmm. But I actually picked up a huge sense of resilience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of sort of, yeah, we hear this. We're not tone deaf, but we're going to keep going.
Science is science, economics
science
is economics.
Science. This makes sense. And we believe that this is what we stand for. So we keep going.
And to your point, I mean, tomorrow and the day after is a big meeting that WBCSD convenes. And, you know, we learned that there's record attendance.
Yep.
More representation from the U.S. than last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that would all suggest that maybe there are more of these quiet corporate sustainability activists out there and a whole lot of leaders with resilience and determination.
I think one of the other things that corporate leaders could listen to is the way you're talking about this as well, is that framing it in powerful and universal terms rather than the jargon or the kind of areas of sustainability of like, there's that focus internally of the kind of quiet activist where you look at all those elements and you really make a hard business case and you understand all these things. And then when you speak externally, where do you put it in terms that are accessible to anybody and that lots of people can be engaged and involved on? And like the ones like the monumental frame, record-breaking attendance,